I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Professor Michael Kagan, discussing the legal status and policy implications of non-Jewish refugees in Israel. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's been a very interesting couple of weeks for me personally, hosting Alan Marinus, leader of the contemporary Musar movement, last weekend, and then Rabbi Harold Kushner, an extraordinary rabbi, teacher, and influential author, last night at my own congregation, Temple Emmanuel, here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live. These 2 weeks have been a wonderful reminder that individuals really can make a difference, that the work of just one dedicated scholar and teacher, or in this case, two separate ones working in different Jewish fields of endeavor, can change the way people live in meaningful, profound, and holy ways. That is perhaps the most essential lesson that Judaism can teach. For if there's one thing we all need to know, it is that living good, meaningful lives can make a difference in this world. Whether we seek to improve ourselves first, focusing on our own spiritual growth by developing awareness of our own strengths and weaknesses, learning how to focus our character traits, soul traits, some would call them, in positive ways, or whether we learn to see other people in the world in compassionate, wise, and understanding ways, each of us has the capacity to create positive change. The grand phrase for this in Jewish tradition is tikkun olam, repairing the world. But in more down-to-earth terms, this is simply how we better our actions and improve our own lives, and in a small way, all humanity, by the ways we conduct ourselves, our actions for good, and the lessons we learn and teach. Orthodox Jews sometimes call this Torah and the keeping of mitzvot, and it certainly is that, but it's also something else. It's coming to know yourself, your abilities, and your motivations, and focusing them so that you can help address what most needs to be done in this world. Sometimes that comes by finding ways to improve your family's life or helping out a friend. Sometimes it shows up as service to a synagogue or another religious institution or another good organization. Sometimes it results in our addressing the needs of the homeless or the poor, seeking to save the lives of a refugee. Sometimes we show that by visiting the sick or comforting the bereaved. And sometimes we make a difference by learning about a great moral or inspirational tradition and sharing it. When we study in Judaism, we do so in order to apply that learning to make the world itself wiser, better, more caring. All of these ways in which we can help improve the world are part of the incredible Jewish tradition, and all are available to everyone if we simply apply ourselves to study and practice that can lead us to act. That's not to say that all of us are equally gifted teachers, scholars, or counselors, or that our abilities are the same in each area, but each of us has the capacity to be better than we habitually are, and the way to become so is to grow in awareness and commitment. Everyone is blessed with certain talents and traits. Each of us has something special to offer. When we apply ourselves to doing so, we're doing something good in and of itself, a real mitzvah. And when we do so regularly, we have the ability to truly change our lives, and through that, the world. That's probably enough preaching for one morning radio show, but I have to admit that hearing from Alan Marinus and Harold Kushner in back-to-back weeks was highly motivating. Probably worth re-listening to those shows on twojewishradio.com, by the way. On a sillier note, and to play us in this morning, on February 14th, the decidedly secular festival of St. Valentine, here's my friend, Rabbi Joe Black's delightful tune, Valentine's Day is not a Jewish holiday.
Valentine's Day is not a Jewish holiday. That's why I didn't buy you flowers. I was thinking just of you. I know you're proud to be a Jew. It's a most confusing 24 hours. No, I can't be what I ain't. And a day named for a saint doesn't seem to be a kosher celebration. Oh, but when Purim comes, we'll nash on special heart-shaped Hamantaschen and drink Mulligan David wine for our libation. It's a Hallmark holiday, that is all that I can say. I don't know why you think it's so essential. Besides, at $80 a pop, a dozen roses ain't so high. What's the point of getting oh so sentimental? No, I didn't buy Godivas, 'cause the increase in your dress sizes from eating chocolate makes you weep and makes you wail. So open up the bedroom door, don't make me sleep here on the floor. I'll buy perfume for you next week when it's on sale.
That was Rabbi Joe Black. He's very charming. Valentine's Day is not a Jewish holiday. It's not, of course. It's based on an early Christian figure, or maybe several figures, named Valentine. Most likely of these candidates was a priest in Rome who happened to be buried on February 14th, way back in the year 496. His story is supposedly linked to an earlier man named Valentine in the town of Terni, Italy, who was supposed to have been martyred by the Roman Emperor Aurelian. The tradition arose, not based on much fact, that this Valentine helped persecuted Christians and was martyred for doing so. The holiday that evolved to become a lover's festival in the Middle Ages was also associated with a variety of pagan observances of ritual love. Anyway, not a Jewish holiday at all, but try telling that to your wife or significant other and see just how far that gets you. When we return in a few moments on To Jewish, our guest, Professor Michael Kagan, will explore the implications, both legal and moral, of the large influx of non-Jewish refugees who have sought asylum in Israel. What does it mean for a nation made up of formerly wandering Jews when others who aren't Jewish wish to come here to stay? Find out when we return on To Jewish.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
Hi, I'm Ben, a student at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can provide Jewish education to families at no cost to you. Direct your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization, and help make great Jewish education affordable. Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. JETCO gives scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K-8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction. When you give to JETCO, you get a 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income tax is reduced by the exact amount you've given. You can give up to $1,067 for a single filer and $2,134 for a married couple. You get that whole amount back from your state income tax. Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442, or go to JETCO.org. You can even choose a future date to process process your payment. How cool is that? Make a tax credit contribution to JETCO and build Jewish identity in Tucson for generations of students. And it won't cost you a dime.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Michael Kagan is Associate Professor of Law at the William Boyd School of Law at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. He is an expert on refugees around the world, and in particular dealing with those in the Middle East and in Israel. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So Israel was founded as a kind of refugee state, primarily for Jews. The law of return is famous. It's now in a circumstance in which lots of non-Jews are seeking asylum. What does that mean, sort of an overall view, and then we can talk about some of the specifics?
Well, it actually means that Israel is typical for its region, not just the Middle East, but southern. Israel essentially shares this challenge with southern Europe. So, although the nationalities are a bit different, but essentially all the countries in that region face the challenge of receiving refugees. And right now, of course, most of the attention is focused on the Syrian refugee crisis, which in a way has not directly affected Israel as much. But even before the Syrian civil war, the severe human rights problems, mostly in the Horn of Africa, so we're talking about Sudan and Eritrea especially, have long led a significant number of people to flee north, and they go into Egypt and sometimes into Libya, but also sometimes towards Israel and towards Turkey, and you'll find the same nationality spread all around the Middle East and into Europe. So it's not a surprising situation at all.
You know, I was in Turkey about a year ago. There were something like 500,000 refugees near me in Harran and eastern Turkey. We were about, I don't know, 10 miles or something, a little less than that from the Syrian border. Syrians don't want to go to Israel, but so many Africans see Israel as a place of refuge. Doesn't Israel see itself that way?
Well, I think Israel struggled with this. I mean, obviously, Israel's a big country with famously a lot of opinions, and so it depends which Israeli you ask. I think Israel is, for a long time, really didn't receive very many asylum seekers, often with fewer than 100 a year. And that's as recent as the time when I lived there between around 2005, 2006, that's when the number started to climb. Now it's received 60,000, mainly Eritrean and Sudanese asylum seekers, and that's a very significant number by any stretch, although minuscule compared to the numbers of Syrians that Israel's neighbors have received. So Israel really, even though it was very committed at its founding to the idea of hosting refugees because of the memory, recent memory of how people fleeing the Nazis were not received, and the awful stories about people who were sent back to Europe to be killed, Israel for decades didn't really have to grapple with the real challenges of receiving people until recently. And the reception from officials from the government has been quite hostile to refugees. I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu has called them a threat to the existence of the Jewish state. And so that level of rhetoric has not been very helpful. Other parts of Israeli society, ranging at different times from Yad Vashem to obviously the Israeli human rights movement, but other parts of civil society and sometimes local governments have sometimes been more or less welcoming. And that many of the challenges in receiving people would be familiar to anyone living in Arizona, for sure, just in terms of the issues that come with any number of immigrants arriving. And so they're not specific to Israel, per se. But Israel's really struggled with this, I think, in terms of trying to figure out whether it can have an open door.
And we will talk more about the specific Israeli response when we come back with Michael Kagan in just a few moments here on Two Jewish. We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes. Propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin, flavorings from Flavor Art in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Thank Always you. A pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com, TOOJewishRadio18@gmail, or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. We have less than 9 months until we elect a new president of the United States. We continue our election year feature, the 2016 Two Jewish Presidential Report. It was on Saturday Night Live recently. Did you even know that show is still on the air? That Bernie Sanders and Larry David appeared together in a skit about arriving in America. Larry David asks Sanders who he is, and Sanders replies,
I am Bernie Sanders-Witzky. But we're going to change it when we get to America so it doesn't sound quite so Jewish.
Well, in spite of the fact that Sanders might just be too Jewish, he is now the very first Jew to actually win a presidential primary. Bernie Sanders defeated Hillary Clinton 60% to 39% in New Hampshire last week, and the surprisingly even Democratic race for the nomination heads on to a number of primaries and caucuses in the next 3 weeks. Sanders still is a pretty long shot to actually defeat Clinton, but each week it gets more interesting. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And happy St. Valentine's Day.
Oh, and the same to you.
You know, it's funny. Valentine's Day comes from the Roman community. It's about as non-Jewish a holiday as you could get. We were talking earlier about the fact that the New York Times said recently that the Roman Jewish community was the oldest diaspora community, which is only wrong by a factor of about 500 years. Let's talk about the diaspora, the first diaspora, the Jews who were exiled from Israel at the Babylonian destruction of 586 or thereabouts.
Right. Good idea. And as I always tell my students, you can't believe everything you read, even if it's in the New York Times.
Maybe especially at times.
No, but I gave them an article about the Pope's recent visit to the Grand Synagogue in Rome. And the article claimed that the Jewish community of Rome was the oldest community in the diaspora, and that's simply not true. It's probably the oldest Jewish community in Western Europe, or maybe even in the European Union, possibly, but certainly, as you said, by a factor of several centuries, not the oldest in the world. So, to the east of Israel, and to the east of Rome, certainly, are many really ancient Jewish communities, some of which date back to the destruction of the First Temple in 586 BCE, and some of which are slightly younger, but still layers of antiquity. And, you know, the first ones that come to mind are the communities mostly vanished or much diminished, but still living a precarious existence in places like Tehran, for sure. The communities in Iran and Iraq, sort of ancient Persia and ancient Babylonia. And I've told the story on your show before of meeting a rabbi in Shiraz near the ancient capital of Persepolis, which was the capital of Cyrus the Great.
The great Persian Empire that came into an empire.
Right. And that rabbi was like an 85th generation rabbi in the same town.
Wow.
Which was, you know, an amazing kind of historic continuity that like, you don't find anywhere in Western Europe.
Back to the time of Mordechai or the Book of Esther.
Right,
or nearly.
Exactly. Or earlier even.
Maybe earlier. Right.
Right. So I think one common mistake among American Jews, even highly educated American Jews, is that we think of the Jewish world as being divided into two groups, Ashkenazim and Sephardim, meaning Eastern European Jews whose ancestors or forebears spoke Yiddish, and Jews who were originally from the southwestern extreme of Europe, the Iberian Peninsula, whose ancestors once spoke Ladino. And there are people descended from those people who still do speak Ladino in Turkey, in Greece, in Bulgaria, in Bosnia, sort of the Southern Balkans, and interestingly, certain communities in the U.S. I mean, I go with my friends regularly to a synagogue in Seattle where aliyahs are auctioned off in Ladino. And so you hear this ancient Spanish kind of people bid for aliyahs. It's quite an interesting tradition. But the point here is that all these really ancient Jewish communities in the diaspora, whether you're talking about Egypt or Syria or Turkey or Iran or Iraq, are neither Ashkenazic nor Sephardic. They're the Edot HaMizrach, the communities of the East.
Sometimes called Oriental Jews, which is a strange term, but one that's still used now and then.
Right.
We'll look at some more of those communities when we talk next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivinah in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Last week we started talking about breaking the silence, IDF soldiers, that is Israeli soldiers, many of them officers, who talk about what it's like to be deployed in the West Bank, in the Shtachim, in the territories. And you mentioned the term bad apples, and I wanted to just clarify something. You didn't mean that the people who are breaking the silence are bad apples.
No.
Okay.
Definitely no. It doesn't say that I agree with how they decide to act, but definitely I appreciate everyone who is stand for what he believes in, and definitely the bad apples are the soldiers, the IDF soldiers that sometime, and this is really a rare situation, and my problem with breaking the silence, that when they're taking only these rare only the bad stories, who really are not the majority of the stories. There is no news channel that will be happy to share great stories of Israeli IDF soldiers. Anyway, so the bad apple, as you said, is the soldiers who are not acting appropriately,
right?
Appropriately in times of war
they
and in times
of
taking definitely taking advantage of the circumstances. And as we said last week, it's occupation is bad to everyone.
So let's talk about occupation and the Israeli public opinion. We hear from a variety of opinion makers about what Israelis think of the occupation, but what do you think most Israelis feel about Yehuda and Shomron, Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, the continued occupation of the West Bank, and the various areas there?
So first of all, some of your listener, will argue about the terms, occupation, yes, no, Yehuda, Shomron, Shtachim. But anyway, what's important is to say that the majority of Israelis in this point, like in, 2016, really just want to move on, just want to live in peace with our neighbors. And it's not a secret that the majority of Israel, more than 50% of the Israelis we will be willing to give up some of the some of the shtachim, some of the land, just to compromise, because it's like any other solution seems like non-realistic. You know, there's people who lived here. Yeah, we have the right. Yeah, God gave it to Abraham. Yeah, all these stories.
Yes, we, you know, yes. They attacked us. We took it in war or whatever.
Yeah, but they lived here for many, many years, for hundreds of years, more than hundreds. So there is also, there is the, you know, the our belief and the history, of course, who support, you know, the Jewish people, the right of the Jewish people to have a Jewish state in Israel. Yes, but on the other hand, there is reality. And the reality is there is people who lives here and we need to compromise with them. So to answer your question, I think the majority of Israelis are willing, you know, actually praying.
There'd be some
really
compromise and we'll end up with a peaceful solution.
That's, that belief that occupation is bad for both Jewish and Arabs in Israel.
Thanks, Oshrat. We will talk next week.
Thank you.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our expert on Jewish education, our maven, John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Boker Tov, everybody.
Jewish education goes back to the earliest days of Judaism. We've been around for, 3,800 years. The Torah has been around for more than 3,200 years. It means instruction.
Yeah.
So when you're designing a curriculum to teach Jewish education today in a modern pluralistic, whether it's a day school like THA, mm-hmm. whether it's a supplementary school like we have at Temple Emanuel or other synagogues, how do you go about both this incredible wealth of tradition that you have to deal with and this tradition that this is how you should teach it. You learn Torah, then you learn Talmud and so on, and then making it relevant in a very, very different world.
It's such an important question because you want school to be an exciting place for kids. You want them energized, on fire, passionate about what they're learning and what they're experiencing. So it's a mixed bag of strategies. You need the right people with the right mindset. You need great materials. And you also need to know what your community is looking for. What are the needs of the families? What are the kids interested in? And so there's a balancing act. And with our centuries-old tradition, we have so much wealth to tap into. But at the same time, we've got 21st century kids, and they're pulled in a lot of directions. So the trick is to build a program that is what we call meaningful and relevant, where the kids feel they're connected, they're part of what's happening. And so part of it is knowing what interests kids, what's exciting for kids. You always want students that are participating in the learning process, not a situation where kids sit and get information, but they're rather participants in learning the information. There's an old model of what we used to call the sage on the stage, where the teacher would present and the kids would sit and listen. And we move towards a more engaging model where the teacher is more like a farmer who sets the landscape, waters and tills, provides fertilizer and weeds, if you will.
Some people think teachers provide a lot of fertilizer. I just want to...
Well, teaching is an art and a science, you know, and some of that fertilizer goes a long way in the relevancy piece.
Yes.
So it's knowing what your kids are interested in and at the same time what your goals are as an educator and as an educational system. What are the outcomes? What do you want your kids to know and be able to do? And then how do you plan accordingly? And it's exciting work, and it's work that needs to be revisited frequently in schools because what worked 10 years ago might not be as meaningful and relevant today.
Boy, it's true. It changes quickly. Our society changes, they say, at an ever accelerating pace.
Yeah.
This is a good subject. Maybe we'll come back to it next week. Thanks, John.
Sounds great.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is going May 29th to June 9th, 2016. If you're interested in going on this fabulous journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to amazing Jerusalem, please email 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie do, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Bernie is in the hospital for a series of tests when Dr. Morris enters the room. Bernie, says Dr. Morris, I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but your tests come back and the news isn't good. In fact, it's about as bad as it could be. Your condition is both terminal and untreatable. Oy vey, cries Bernie. So, how much time do I have left? 8, replies Dr. Morris. 8 what? Asks Bernie. 8 years? 8 months? 8 days? Looking at his watch, Dr. Morris replies, 8, 7, 6, 5. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Titzaveh in the book of Exodus, a ritually oriented parsha which gives the commandment to create a Ner Tamid, an eternal light for the tabernacle in the wilderness. The tabernacle was the first sanctuary of the people of Israel, although, technically speaking, the tabernacle, the Mishkan, was a very elaborate, portable tent. It was also the place where God's presence, the Shekhinah, resided. In a sense, that's where God lived, or more accurately, since God is everywhere, it was where God was most available to us humans. Last week in Truma, our ancestors were asked to create this sacred space through the voluntary gifts of their hearts. This week, we're told that there should be a continual fire, a Ner Tamid, a constant light shining on the altar, sign of God's faithful and permanent presence in our midst. Revealingly, that light is to be created and kindled by us, not God. We must build the altar and the fire and continue to feed and nurture it to keep it alive. And if you've ever kept a fire burning around the clock, say at a camp out or bonfire, for heat on a cold winter's night in some frigid clime, you know just how much fuel you need to do it. You're always either stoking it or bringing in more wood for it to burn. If neglected for any length of time, that fire will burn out. The Ner Tamid was therefore not just a symbol, but a process requiring regular care and feeding to flourish. Our own spiritual lives are rather like that ancient Ner Tamid. If we wish God's presence to illuminate our lives, to give us warmth and comfort, then we too must feed our own Ner Tamid, must gently and regularly add spiritual fuel to that flame. Religious experiences, prayer, meditation, introspection, saying blessings, personal and communal rituals, studying, time for breathing and allowing God into our lives. All of these help feed the fire, and they must be done with regularity, or our own internal, eternal lights will go out. The Ner Tamid, that ancient light, is found today in every synagogue in the world, no matter how humble the shul or how grand the temple. While today we simply pay electric bills to keep them alive, even that requires a bit of active participation, but its symbolic purpose is much greater. The Ner Tamid burns always to remind us that God is with us always, if we only take the time to feed our own spiritual fires regularly. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, law professor Michael Kagan, will explore the implications of the non-Jewish refugee influx into Israel. What does it mean for the Jewish state legally, and what is the impact on a country founded as a Jewish haven when so many non-Jews see it as a potential homeland? Find out when we return shortly on To Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life, 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The implications and complications from the Israeli government's announced agreement to create an egalitarian prayer area at the Western Wall, the Kotel in Jerusalem, dominated Jewish news last week. Women of the Wall drew 100 women to its monthly service, more than twice its typical attendance, a week and a half after the adoption of a compromise over the future of prayer at the Western Wall. Haredi ultra-Orthodox protesters shouted insults at the worshippers. One of them even burned one of the prayer books. The Women of the Wall conduct monthly services in the women's section of the wall. That group was unable to pray with the Torah as the site's regulations continue to prohibit Torahs in the women's section. That will not be true in the egalitarian section that is going to be built. Usually Women of the Wall attracts about 30 to 40 worshipers to their monthly service. The deal reached last month will expand a non-Orthodox prayer section south of the traditional Orthodox prayer area of the site at the so-called Davidson Archaeological Park, which will be run by a non-Orthodox committee. A shared entrance leads to both sections. The wall's Orthodox prayer area will remain under Haredi control, but not this new area. Women of the Wall agreed to the deal and will move to the expanded non-Orthodox section once it's completed, a process that will likely take some years. Once there, the group will pray behind a partition that keeps them away from the view of Orthodox Haredim. A break off from the group has rejected the deal, however, and continues to vow to pray in the Orthodox women's section. We sang with the feeling that now we truly begin a new path to being a free people in our own land, Women of the Wall chairwoman Anat Hoffman, a past guest of Two Jewish, said, quoting HaTikvah, Israel's national anthem. But it may not prove to be that simple. Nine senior Israeli archaeologists addressed a letter to Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu last week that said that creating a new plaza at the Western Wall, or expanding the current one anyway, will damage the most important archaeological site for the Jewish people. Signatories to the protest letter included Dan Bahat, who excavated part of the paved road beneath Robinson's Arch, Jerusalem Prize winner Gabriel Barkai, who directs the Temple Mount Sifting Project, and Israel Prize laureate Amichai Mazar, one of the most famous archaeologists in Israel. The archaeological protest comes after predictably angry responses from ultra-Orthodox groups. The Western Wall Heritage Foundation, the extremely Orthodox entity that currently controls the Kotel Plaza, approved the plan. But various Haredim complained anyway, and of course the Palestinian Waqif, Yusuf Ides, who claims that the Kotel should be considered a Muslim holy site, they'll next claim St. Peter's too, argued that this new site would Judaicize the holy site, an odd claim to make about what is already the holiest place in the world for Jews. The archaeologists are concerned that the character of the Davidson Archaeological Park, where the new plaza extension will somehow be transformed negatively from archaeology to prayer. Having conducted bar mitzvahs in that space already, I can personally tell you that it's both awe-inspiring and beautiful, and that making it more accessible can scarcely conceal the power of that space. In spite of the prominence of the archaeologists in question, the Israel Antiquities Authority approved the plan to allow a space for mixed-gender reform and conservative prayer in the newly enlarged area. And now I'll share one too Jewish self-congratulatory note. Back in May of 2014, a fascinating man named David Stoliar died. Stoliar was the sole survivor of a Jewish refugee ship fleeing Hitler in 1942 with 800 passengers on it, a ship called the Struma that was sunk during World War II in the Black Sea. It was the worst civilian ship tragedy of the war. Well, we here on Two Jewish reported that story shortly after Stoliar died in Bend, Oregon, nearly 2 years ago. But just 2 weeks ago, that news reached the New York Times, America's paper of record. They ran the obituary with the note, "His death was little noted outside of Oregon." While the Times told Stoliar's story of survival and testimony quite well way back in 2000, and we covered his actual death in 2014, apparently in this age of the internet, it took almost 2 years for news to travel from Oregon to New York City and the editorial offices of the New York Times. I think that news went faster to New York in the days of the Pony Express. Anyway, we got it right, and that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Michael Kagan, is the Associate Professor of Law at the William Boyd School of Law at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, expert on refugees around the world. We've been talking about non-Jews who seek asylum in Israel and the Israeli response. So if you are an African, you come to the border of Israel, or somehow or other you get across the border, what's going to happen to you?
Well, right now you're likely to be sent to a detention camp. There's been a lot of litigation at the Israeli High Court about that and about how long someone can be kept in a detention camp. The general policy seems to have been two things. One, to try to prevent Sudanese and Eritreans from settling in any way, even temporarily, in Israel, particularly in the economic center, so that the area around Tel Aviv primarily, to keep them marginalized. I hope that they will be miserable and leave. It has a lot of echoes of in the U.S. of Mitt Romney's self deportation idea. The other is that there has been tightening at the border, and Israel seems to be the Egyptians seem to be helping Israel keep people out to some extent and doing that in a very brutish way. So the number of people been shot in Sinai by Egyptian forces trying to reach the Israeli border. So you have scenes there that in some ways might be evocative of, say, the Cold War of East Germans trying to get over the wall and being shot on their way out. In that going on in Egypt with people trying to reach Israel. You also remember these are people who are using smuggling networks, so they're dealing with organized criminals who are not nice people either. And so you have extortion of the refugees along the way, and you have sometimes horrible abuses by the smuggling networks. And that's a global phenomenon, and we see the same thing with Central American kids coming up through Mexico, the same kind of abuses, and you can find that in Sinai. I mean, Sinai, for hundreds of years, has been a smuggling route, and lots of things have been smuggled through Sinai, and right now it's people, among other things.
You know, you think of the term coyotes in terms of the people who do the transportation, some of them from Mexico, the United States, bringing often Central Americans. Is there a term for those people that are crossing the Sinai?
Yeah, you know, I've worked in Egypt extensively. I ran a legal aid center for refugees in Cairo, and I've also worked in Tel Aviv. I never heard a term as colorful as coyote to what we have here, although the phenomenon is exactly the same. And I know in Cairo that I would hear from refugees that about people who would stand, for instance, outside churches that served the refugee population in Cairo and tell people about, I could take you to Europe or I could take you to Israel. And we had clients in Cairo who we were trying to help, and that wasn't easy in Egypt, and then they would disappear. And sometimes I would hear from my colleagues in Tel Aviv that we have your client here a week or two later. And sometimes, of course, they would actually just disappear, which was very scary, and they may have ended up in Europe. And of course, given the number of people who die at sea trying to reach Europe, it's pretty scary when you know that's where someone might have gone, and you don't hear from them again. You just never know.
You know, I think people may not be aware, but I remember in the days before Hamas and Gaza and ISIS, you could take a Bedouin cab if you crossed into the Sinai, and you could be in Sharm el-Sheikh in 3 hours or something.
So right.
Not, you know, we think of the Sinai, it took 40 years to cross, but it's not actually that huge.
No, it's very small. I think that really comes across when you live there. It's like driving across down the New Jersey Turnpike. And I mean, I grew up in the Northeast, so that's my point
that's
of
your
reference.
Frame of reference, right?
Yeah, but I mean, my colleague who I worked with at in Tel Aviv, Anat Ben-Dor, told me that her grandfather before 1948 was a carpet salesman between Beirut and Jaffa. So, I mean, this is not a big area. It's definitely, I mean, people used to cross it in caravans in medieval times. It's the distances are not tremendous.
When the Israeli public debates this question, I mean, there's no doubt that Israel strongly believes in the right of return of Jews having a place of asylum, since the only Jewish country in the world. How do people reconcile the belief in Judaism that refugees should have a place to go with protecting or not allowing African refugees to come into Israel?
Well, I think Israel is torn, always has been. This is a story of many issues in Israel between those the moral call to welcome the stranger, especially one who is fleeing, the secular international human rights call to do the same, versus secular nationalism. I think we ought to always need to remember that that some streams of Zionism are religious, and so, but it's also a form of secular nationalism. And so, to some extent, some parts of the Israeli public who react negatively to refugees are reacting, I think, the same way that you'll see people on the right in Europe reacting. That you could fill in the blank. This country is Danish or French or Jewish. In a sense, the reaction is the same when someone who's not in that group arrives. certain part of the public is hostile. And obviously, the struggle in Israel has always been how do you balance the commitment to democracy and human rights with the desire to be a Jewish state when not everyone there is Jewish. Obviously, that's has been a central problem on a number of issues, and this is a recent one.
When this issue comes up, is there a racial component to it, since so many of these immigrants are Africans?
Unfortunately, there is. That has been evidenced in statements that have been made by Israeli officials. So, for example, the Israeli Minister of Interior at one point said, we don't need to import more problems from Africa. Most of those people arriving here are Muslims who think the country doesn't belong to us, the white man. It's not the current Israeli Minister of Interior, but it's hard to imagine an American official talking that way, but I think he was giving voice to a sense that some people definitely have, and that's obviously a problem. Of course, you can find people in Europe saying much the same thing, and occasionally here in the U.S. too. It's perhaps not what Abraham Lincoln would call the better angels of our nature.
Boy, not at all. What do you see in the future, playing, Prophet Navi here? This wasn't a problem that Israel envisioned 10 years ago, although mm-hmm. I do remember a film, James's Journey to Jerusalem, about Africans who had come to Israel to work and then kind of seeking asylum who were being deported. So obviously it's been around, but not in these numbers. Do you anticipate this problem becoming more acute, Israel figuring a way into some reasonable balance on this?
I have learned from being very bad at it to not predict the future. What I would say has changed is that Israel built a wall on the southern border. There was long been a wall on the Gaza border, if you look at a map. But so we're talking about the southern part of the Sinai border, where Israel directly borders Egypt. And that has severely cut down on the numbers of people arriving. And Israel could, the optimistic view would be that Israel will somehow sort this out, that some people will leave, some people will stay, and hopefully Israel would find a way to deal with those who stay. That Israel has a large migrant worker population who come in legally, and their numbers are larger than the numbers of refugees. So it's not as if Israel is unable to host non-Jewish migrants. So far, it remains a very hostile approach to the refugees, with very inflated rhetoric about the supposed threat that they pose to the state. I don't know whether that will be resolved. It's a struggle that many countries are facing about how to deal with uninvited immigrants.
It's almost it's a ubiquitous problem for first world countries now. Israel is clearly a first world country. I want to thank Professor Michael Kagan for bringing up this issue and illuminating the complexity of it for us this morning. Where can people go to find out more about these issues?
Well, I'm coming to Tucson to give two talks next week, so you can come to that. Otherwise, I would say the Hotline for Migrant Workers, which is a fabulous Israeli organization, has a great website in both English and Hebrew that people can look to for information about this.
Thanks so much, and appreciate the work that you do.
Thank you for talking to me about this.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Professor Mark Kliegman, the very first Mickey Katz Chair of Jewish Music at my alma mater, UCLA. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from a favorite world music band, Les Yeux Noirs, their version of the wonderful Yiddish lullaby, Reshenkis Mitmandlin. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Ich will bei euch a Kasche fragen, sag mir, wer es kennt. Mit welche Teiere vermägens bencht Gott alle Menschen. Man kauft es nicht für kein Geld, das gibt man noch umsiehst. Und doch, als man verliert, das wie viel Tränen man vergisst. A zweite gibt man keinem nicht, es hilft nicht kein Gewein. Oh, wer es hat verloren. Der weist schon, was ihr mein. A jüdische Mame, es gibt nicht besser in die Welt. A jüdische Mame, oi weh wie bitter, wenn sie fällt. Wie schön und lirtig ist in euch, wenn die Mames du.